Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Despite the New York Times' unfounded rumor about a lack of healthy green kale here in Louisiana, our state is literally bursting with innovative healthy practices. From the incredibly biodiverse acres at Mahaffey Farms to Sharon Floyd's application of Ayurvedic medicine in cocktails and Molly Kimball's Eat Fit NOLA, Louisiana's got it going on in the good health department. Good health means good eats and drinks on this week's Louisiana Eats.
If I start focusing on money and wealth building, I think I'll neglect the principles that are going to build it the right way. I didn't get into this to get rich, but I think we can build something that can take care of our family.
That's Evan McCommon on his family's land, Mahaffey Farms. Located outside of Bossier City, Mahaffey Farms has been in Evan's family since 1927 and thrived as a working farm for decades before Evan's great uncle passed away.
The path of least resistance was, if these pine trees are trying to grow here, let's let them do it. So we started raising pine timber.
Which they grew until the timber economy bottomed out a few years ago.
I'm like, what are we going to do? You know, I had all my eggs in one basket. So how can I diversify? How can I figure out other ways to keep this family land alive and invigorate it?
Evan started looking for solutions and found that the most diverse farms were usually on savanna pastures.
Basically what savanna means is widely spaced trees. That a forest is a dark, foreboding, dark place, you know, and really savanna has grass, has multiple layers of different size plant species growing together. And it's actually because of that, you basically have more surface area and you're collecting more solar energy than any other system on the planet in a savanna, which supports more species. There's the three major environments of forest, open land, and water. And where the three of those come together is where you're going to have the most abundant life. So we're trying to create as much of that as possible. And the savanna is the most abundant life-producing system we can mimic in nature.
So he started the conversion, trimming back trees and clear-cutting some dense forest. But the land was always Evan's first priority.
It's pretty exciting. I mean, we're starting to see results. If you look over there, I mean, literally, I think maybe we're pushing 8 months now, that was just thick pulpwood pine. And look at it, it's just chest-high grass with dappled oaks, and the oaks are going to provide master forage for our pigs.
Evan modeled his North Louisiana farm after Joel Salatin's Polyface Farms in Western Virginia. You may know Joel Salatin from The Omnivore's Dilemma and Food, Inc. Joel offers internships for aspiring farmers at Polyface Farms, and Evan was fortunate to have studied there with the legendary farmer.
I'm not bashful about saying I copied everything exactly almost. The way I built my pens, the way I built my eggmobile. And that's kind of like, you know, well, you know, you're just copying Joel Salatin. Well, yeah, that's like a basketball player copying Michael Jordan, of course.
Exactly. No need to reinvent the wheel.
No,
and
it's working
great. If you learn from the master.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're making adjustments for our southern climate. You know, it's a little bit different than the Shenandoah Valley here. A little bit different soil, a little bit different heat. And so just little minor changes.
One of the big things he's adopted is a group of movable pasture pens for his chickens, known as chicken tractors. They're 10 by 12 foot shelters made out of aluminum siding that come up to your knees.
And the way they work is you move the chickens every day, and this gets them access to fresh green grass on pasture, bugs, the environment that a chicken's supposed to be in and the nutrition that they're supposed to get, instead of being locked in a dark house on top of their own excrement. These are moved every day to fresh, clean ground off of yesterday's manure. And the way Joel Salatin designed them was also a production method to where you can go out and one person can move 1,000 birds in half an hour. And so this is about 300 birds, and I can move them in about 20 minutes. And that includes feeding them, watering them, moving the pens, everything.
But chickens aren't the only animals Evan's raising on the farm. He's got cattle, goats, and pigs.
We have four groups of pigs on the farm right now. And we don't just raise red wattles. Like I said, I'm into hybrid vigor. We have a lot of crossbreeds. We have red wattles mixed with Hampshires and blue butts. And we have some pure red wattles, and some of them are, we don't even know. Just pigs. A pig is a woodland creature. They are exceptionally good at taking, putting them in the forest and turning the soil over and creating just the right amount of disturbance to invigorate for us converting from timber or in forest to a savanna pasture. They're the perfect animal to help us do the work.
Pigs are an important part of the mix at Mahaffrey Farms. Some were feeding in their pens while others roamed free, grazing in the shade of the tall pines.
I like to look at old livestock books and see what did the pigs look like back in the 1920s and 30s. Because back then, you know, there hadn't been bred for confinement facilities. Everybody was raising pigs outside. Let's just find old genetics, closest to the wild source. That's another way to look at it. This is where they're meant to be. There's a reason why a pig has a plow on the end of its nose. It's so that it can forage for roots and bugs and all these different things. I like flavor in my food, and raising things on pasture and letting the animals get to maturity. A 300-pound pig rather than a 200-pound pig actually develops a better flavor over time, especially when you finish them with acorns or on pasture with real green forage and real food instead of just corn. And that's what their meat's supposed to taste like.
As much as possible, Evan lets Mother Nature do the heavy lifting while he attends to the farm's management.
So, like, if you add pigs to your operation, that encourages 8 more species, or it will support them. So by putting these pigs here, we're going to bring in different types of birds that we're going to, you know, rely on them for different things, and different insects and different plants are going to thrive with the addition of each species. So I'm excited about having just thousands and thousands of, I want this place to be just the Garden of Eden is what I'm trying to build.
As we crossed back through the chicken pasture, we got a great overview of Mahaffrey Farms. A small lake was to our right, the savanna pasture to our left, and a dense timber forest could be seen on the horizon. Of the 1,100 acres available, only 300 have been converted to farmland.
We're still going to keep timber as our mainstay, and that's our primary product. And if this continues to expand, you know, in 10 years from now, this 300 acres will be a very prosperous savanna. And then we'll be looking at the next block of land that's adjacent and say, okay, where is it in the management plan? Is it ready for some thinning and savanna work? That's the thing, it's a really a legacy for me, is that my uncle left this for us. He left this thing, and the family, not by any fault of our own, but just no one was here to do it. And so now I'm taking over and saying, okay, we're going to keep this family legacy in this farm, and we're going to turn it into something that we're proud to pass on. And then I'm happy to see something real get done with it instead of it turning into another real estate development. We don't want to see more suburban sprawl. We want to see sustainable agriculture sprawl is what I want to see.
Evan McCommon sells fresh produce and pastured meats at farmers markets in the greater Shreveport area. You can also buy directly from his family's farm in Princeton, Louisiana. Visit MahaffreyFarms.com for more information. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Evan McCommon isn't the only one who basks in the glow of Joel Salatin. Former journalist turned farmer Suzanne Nelson has been hugely influenced by Joel's farming methods. She uses his progressive techniques on her land in North Carolina. While these holistic approaches define how she raises her livestock, the success of her farm is dependent on the community that surrounds it. When we sat down with Suzanne, her enthusiasm was palpable.
Pigs and chickens are omnivores, and in the absence of having enough food to scavenge, in nature they would find mice, they would find grubs, they would find other things of sources of protein in addition to the pasture and things. In the absence of having a sufficient quantity of that, they need to eat some protein and energy that's supplemented. And so that, in the United States, comes in the form of grain. But I didn't want to feed them amalgamated, extruded, genetically modified, Roundup-ready soybeans and corn. That was not the point of me doing all this. At the end of the day, you can ask a chicken to go out on pasture, you can give her fresh grass every day, and 90% of what that hen puts in her mouth, nutritionally speaking, is what comes out of that feed trough. So what's in the feed matters a lot. Don't get me wrong, the pasture matters a lot too, but the feed matters. So I started going to our local co-op and buying wheat and buying corn, and I ground it in my home flour mill, and it didn't work very well. And then I met a guy named George Teague, I went up there one day to buy some minerals for my cow, and he said, well, that's silly. I have a mill. I could mill you some feed. So in the beginning, I would mix all the supplements, the herbs, the vitamins, the minerals, the probiotics. I would mix them in a little bin in my driveway in a Rubbermaid tote, and I'd hand mix them, and then I'd bring them up, and he mixed the grains, and we would bag it in his driveway, and feed would spill everywhere, and it was an ordeal. But now he's gotten some grants, and he has a large mill, and he's a regional organic feed supplier. And it's excellent feed, and when my daughter sticks her hand in that feed trough and tries some, it doesn't freak me out. It's real food.
Now, let's talk about the old Jerseys who no longer have a purpose at the dairy cheese farm where they've been living.
Well, we have a partnership with a wonderful, wonderful cheesemakers, Portia McKnight and Flo Holly of Chapel Hill Creamery. We wanted cows, and they didn't have cows for sale. But I knew their older cows, who had some troubles, they weren't perfect anymore because they're getting on in years. I knew that they were better for me to start with than some younger animals from less desirable stock. And so we've kind of adopted a bunch of their cows. I mean, these cows are 9, 10. I mean, that's old for a dairy cow. And in conventional U.S. agriculture, those dairy cows only last until they're 3, and then they're Hardee's hamburgers. So we have a bunch of them, and we're trying to get babies out of them. And the other thing that we're doing with Portia and Flo is we're buying their bull calves and grafting them, as it's known, on mamas. So Jerseys, so milk cows, have more milk than their baby can drink. It's one of the anomalies, if you will, about what we've kind of bred cows to be. One of the things that a pasture-based system allows you is a little bit more freedom to do some interesting, innovative things. And so I'm not the first to do this, but one of the things we're doing is raising rose veal. So veal has gotten a deservedly bad reputation in the United States because the animals, when they were not hit over the head or drowned in the river, they were put in teeny crates. They were not allowed to turn around. They were never allowed to eat anything but milk replacer. So a cow's rumen, a bovine's rumen, needs fiber. They need forage in order to be normal. These little babies were given an all-liquid diet to keep their meat very, very pale. I mean, their meat looks like chicken. I mean, it's not beef in any real sense, but that was what was desired from a culinary point of view. Our bull calves, I think, have the best life of any animal on our farm. They are either born on our farm or born in Chapel Hill Creamery. They come, they get either their own mother's milk or an adopted mother's milk, and they drink all the milk they want to drink. They frolic with their mothers in the pasture. They eat all the hay they want to eat. They get moved to fresh grass twice a day. They're not castrated. They're not dehorned. They're not weaned. They have all the good things in life and none of the bad things of being a farm animal. And we harvest them about 7 months at about 550 pounds. So they're big boys by then. I mean, they're not babies. They have thick necks, and they look like young men. And they start acting like young men, too. And their meat is really unbelievable. It's extremely tender beef. It looks like beef. It doesn't look like veal. It's rose in hue. It hadn't had the time to develop into a true, true, really deep red. It's more of a rosy red. It's extremely forgiving to cook, and it has a milk finish. You can taste the milk, and it's the best meat I've ever had.
So we've talked about the animals, and we've talked about how this all came to be. part of the equation that you were working on that seems to be working out for you is how you actually sell your products from the farm. Let's talk about the relationship you have with that very, very special business in North Carolina.
So we're proud to be partners with the Saks Baja General Store. They buy a lot of our meat and eggs and put it on their menu, and we also retail a lot of meat through their case. So I buy feed from George Teague at Reedy Fork Farms. I feed it to my animals. One of the animals that we raise on that feed are broiler chickens, meat chickens. I turn and process those chickens and sell them to the Saks Baja General Store. They pay me. I turn around and pay George. And so all of a sudden we have community and we have people who are able to create something that individually we wouldn't be able to create. I've been known many, many a days to eat three meals a day at the general store. So they truly feed me and nourish me, and that makes our farm possible.
Suzanne, I am so thrilled that you happened to marry a guy from Louisiana. So hopefully that will bring you back to visit with us again on Louisiana Eats.
Absolutely. I'd love to come back. Thanks for having me, Poppy.
Suzanne Nelson of Cozy Farms in North Carolina.
What exactly is quinoa and why is it such a big deal? We'll answer that question and make you hungry for some quinoa when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What exactly is quinoa and why is it such a big deal? Quinoa is a member of the plant family goosefoot, which is related to amaranth. It's a broadleaf plant that's kin to spinach, beets, and tumbleweed. The quinoa we eat are actually the plant seeds, and it's often referred to as a superfood. Archaeological evidence even suggests that man has been consuming quinoa for 7,000 years. Maybe that's because it not only tastes good, but it's incredibly good for you. Quinoa is a complete protein that's gluten-free. It's also a good source of fiber and high in phosphorus, magnesium, and iron. It's also high in calcium, which makes it a perfect food for vegans and those who are lactose intolerant. Serve it hot or cold. It's a great substitute for rice and easily showcases the flavor of fresh herbs from the garden. I love the way those little grains pop between my teeth with a satisfyingly nutty flavor. Are you ready to start cooking quinoa? Stay tuned, and we'll talk about the best methods of cooking it and the best ways to eat it. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Now that you know how good quinoa is for you, it's time to start cooking it. First, rinse the quinoa well. It can often have a bitter residue that rinsing will remove. Then, if you want to use it cold in salads, add 2 parts water to 1 part quinoa, just like cooking rice. Don't forget to add some salt. It really needs it. Bring the water and quinoa to a boil, then cover and reduce to a simmer. In 20 minutes, you'll have fluffy, beautiful quinoa ready to take on the flavors of any ingredients you'd like to showcase in a salad. For a warm version, first sauté some onion in a little butter or olive oil, then add the quinoa, salt, and water. Cooking is simple. Just boil, then cover, reduce the heat, and simmer for 20 minutes. Olives, sun-dried tomatoes, and grated cheese are delicious additions to quinoa. Just fluff them in towards the end of the cooking process. Trust me, the variety is endless. So get out that jar of quinoa and start experimenting.
For a copy of this recipe, visit our website at itsneworleans.com or wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Health food enthusiast Tess Masters, also known as the Blender Girl, is a food blogger obsessed with using whole foods to make just about anything you can whip up in a blender. Her passion for healthy eating was a result of a diagnosis at an early age.
As a teenager, I was very, very tired, and I kind of always wanted to take a nap. So I just knew there was not, everything wasn't quite right in my body. And so I was reading a medical journal, and I saw this thing called Epstein-Barr virus, and it kind of was one of those things where it says, do you have this? Do you feel like this? Yes, 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 check, check, check. And so I went to my mom and said, I've got this. And she said, you do not have this test. Go to school. And so this went on for about 6 months. And finally, she humored me. We went to the doctor, and I was diagnosed with Epstein-Barr virus. And I went to a naturopath, and he suggested I give up gluten and dairy. And I felt better almost overnight. I'm not a celiac, and I'm not lactose intolerant, but I do have an intolerance to gluten and dairy. And that was really the impetus into a revolution to the way that I ate.
Noticing such a significant improvement in her healthy well-being, Tess soon became inspired by the thought of food as medicine and began experimenting with every dieting trend she could find.
I was macrobiotic for 10 years. I was a raw foodist. I did Chinese yin and yang principles, Ayurvedic philosophies. I was vegan, vegetarian. I really was one of those annoying people that finds the answer every 6 months and tries to recruit everybody they know. And I was really dogmatically following these diets, and I felt very, very good, but I didn't feel as good as I knew that I could. And so finally my dad sat me down and said, are you having fun? Because we're not having any fun watching you eat, you know, watching you cook, and food should be fun, right? And that was a really big wake-up call for me when I realized I didn't have to dogmatically follow these diets. I was really looking for the perfect test diet that was going to bring me to optimal health and well-being. And that can change day by day, week by week, and year by year as my needs change. So the minute that I embraced bioindividuality and the concept that one blanket diet won't work for everybody, my whole world opened up. And I realized that flexibility and fluidity, not rigidity, were among the keys to success and happiness for me. So when I started to research, you know, blending as a method of food prep, the more it quickly became a metaphor for how I live my life, that I like to cherry pick from different philosophies, cultures, notes, flavors, work, loving relationship, hobbies, exercise, and so forth to find my perfect blend for health and happiness.
For Tess, the blender represents a perfect way for everyone to create a healthy diet that fits their individual needs without compromising their taste buds. With her blog and cookbook, The Blender Girl, Tess has been spreading the word using a long list of recipes packed with superfoods.
Anyone can make a typical fruit smoothie. Let's say you were going to throw, you know, in some milk or some juice and mango and banana, for example. Then, to take it to the next level and to balance out the natural sugar of that smoothie, I would always add a cup or two of leafy greens for a start. Those chlorophyll-rich, prebiotic, incredibly nutrient-dense, highly alkalizing foods. That's, again, going to balance out the sugar content. To that smoothie, I would add probably about a teaspoon or half a teaspoon of probiotic powder. Then to even boost it further, I would always add a tablespoon of cold-pressed oil. So it could be coconut, hemp, flax, avocado, macadamia, so forth. And then to that, I would add a superfood powder. So I would add some chia seeds, some hemp seeds, some flax. Maybe I'd add all three. You know, and then I might add, you know, a teaspoon or a tablespoon of acai, maki powder, kamu berry powder, goji berries, pomegranate, something like that. So there's a lot of different ways that you can layer your smoothie for a more nutrient-dense experience. And then on top of that, I love to add herbs and spices, not only because it adds another layer of flavor, but also for medicinal purposes. So for example, ginger, cinnamon, fennel, cayenne, these are all incredibly warming foods, particularly in the winter. They're very, very good for digestion, anti-inflammatory, and also contain nutrients. So I always try and add as many of those different things to a smoothie as possible. And then if I'm going to make other dishes, I apply the same basic principles. So to a salad, I would layer it in very much the same way. But I think one of the biggest recipes that I've been making around the country is the instant sugar-free jam. Using superfoods, I use chia seeds, for example. So, you know, obviously jam is something pretty much everybody loves. It's a staple in most people's houses. We all have a jar of something in our fridge. But the ratio of 2 or 3 parts sugar to 1 part fruit makes my colon spasm just talking about it. So what I love about this jam is not only do I not have to stand at the stove and stir it for 3 hours, it's completely live and raw. So it contains all the live enzymes of the raw fruit, and we're using chia seeds to thicken it. So you're putting that superfood, you know, why chia seeds are so remarkable is not only is it an incredible source of protein, but it's the number one plant-based source of omega-3. So that's very important, you know, for the healthy functioning of the body. So we're not only utilizing the chia seeds to thicken the jam, so we're getting a result that's very close to the taste and texture of a conventional product, but we're also boosting the nutrient content.
Her most famous recipe, a kale smoothie that she says tastes like ice cream.
That's a really wonderful recipe, and I love it for 2 reasons. First of all, you achieve that by I do a cup of water, a cup of curly kale, a half a cup of cashews, a quarter of a cup of dates, a tablespoon of maple syrup, a teaspoon of minced ginger, and a ton of ice, and 2 fresh or frozen bananas. And the alchemy between the kale, the bananas, the cashews, and the ginger creates something that's very reminiscent of an ice cream. It's absolutely delicious. It tastes like dessert. The thing about green smoothies is they're gag-worthy to a lot of people, particularly children. You know, they see something green and they will not have a bar of it. And what I love about this smoothie, it's a dessert smoothie, it's a fun smoothie, but it's the sexiest introduction to green smoothies I've ever tasted because it's fun and delicious. And for healthy fast food to stick, it needs to be fun. So instead of working against expectations, we're working with expectations. So it's got this beautiful pastel green color that's very fun. People taste it and they freak out, and then you gradually train your taste buds and train people that something green can be really delicious. And so then you would reduce the amount of, you know, sweetener and cashews or whatever and start to, you know, maybe introduce a spinach, mango, banana smoothie. And then eventually you try some more kale, and then you'll try some collard greens, and then you'll try some beet greens, and you can start to reduce the amount of sweet sugars and add more vegetable. For me, the book really is about a celebration of healthy fast food. You know, we're all starved for time. It's the most precious commodity we have. And I don't want to compromise on my health and nutrition because I've got something more pressing to do. And enter the blender and healthy fast food becomes possible.
Tess Masters, the Blender Girl. Sharon Floyd is both a yoga instructor and a skilled mixologist. When awarded a Tales of the Cocktail Apprentice Scholarship in 2011, Sharon used it to further her education in Ayurveda, an ancient Hindu method of healing both mind and body. Today, Sharon applies Ayurveda techniques from the yoga mat to the cocktail glass. She created Bartanica, a company that crafts bitters and syrups from locally grown plants used for aromatherapy and in mixed drinks.
Ayurveda is essentially the sister science of yoga. It's thousands of years old. It's the main medical science in India right now. About 80% of their doctors still practice it. But it's very different from Western medicine in that it's a truly holistic approach to healthcare. It focuses on prevention. I wanted to look at the similarities of the plants and the botanicals that make up the cocktail world. I think it's so interesting and so helpful to look at the individual ingredients and to become informed not only as to the overall effect, the overall taste of that product, but also the potential for using plants individually to promote prevention and healing.
So how did you set out to study this? Where'd you go?
My initial studies in Ayurveda were with my teacher's teacher. Jessica's teacher had an online program. And the culmination of that education was in India. I was in Nagpur, India for a few weeks at an Ayurvedic clinic. And I came home as an Ayurvedic practitioner. I've noticed in my days behind the bar, as well as teaching yoga, and now with the Ayurveda practice, there is a lot of crossover. There's a lot of cross-interest. I've got tons of yoga students and Ayurvedic clients who are also interested in mixology or the cocktails to some degree, and vice versa.
So walk me through some of your botanical products.
Well, originally, bitters were created as kind of digestive tonics. We've long known that the bitter taste is important for digestion. Ayurveda recognizes that the bitter taste is also cooling, so this is particularly welcome in the summer.
Yeah, in New Orleans it sure is.
For sure. So the flower flavor is traditionally very cooling. And this is important because Ayurveda distinguishes the different body types by the elements. I make it sound very simplistic, and from a higher level it is. But
I don't know. It sounds kind of complicated to me, actually.
There is a lot of depth to the science itself. The other flavor is a lot more earthy. It's turmeric and black pepper. As I mentioned, you know, we're talking about Ayurveda in the sense that these body types represent different elements. And those elements have either more cooling or more heat. There are some people who just naturally retain more heat in the body. Mm-hmm. They're always hot, you know. Mm-hmm. So Ayurveda recognizes that, okay, well, to treat that extra heat in the body, you need to cool it down. You need to – those are the people who usually have very strong digestion, and they can have, like, raw foods, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the opposite end of that, there's also a body type where individuals are cooler and more sensitive to temperature change and drafts. And those individuals need more grounding, stabilizing tastes and foods.
How do you suggest people use your bitters?
You can definitely use them in cocktails. I think they blend well. You can have them in tea. You can have them in fruit juice, in soda water. I just put them right on my tongue. I love the bitter taste. And people who don't currently enjoy the bitter taste just need to keep giving them a try. I think it's something that, you know, particularly in our culture, we don't emphasize it. It's not a taste that's in the American curriculum, really. We don't really learn about it. We don't really talk about it. And we don't typically seek it out. So I think with the cocktail renaissance that's happening right now, I think there's a renewed interest in that. And I think that beyond the cocktail bar, everyone can benefit from that. One of my favorite aspects of working behind the bar was when you know, go to muddle some fresh ingredients, you get the waft of fresh oils off of the plants. And that's been one of my favorite experiences working with fresh ingredients. And so when I started with essential oils, I wanted to recreate that experience for myself, basically. And that's been the major focus for the aromatherapy aspect of Bartanica, is recreating that cocktail creation experience.
It's very interesting combining these two things, because yoga is all about balance and centering. And so often cocktails are about getting a bit off center.
Well, admittedly, Poppy, a few years ago, it became apparent to me that alcohol had become a vice. And so yoga, in contrast, has been instrumental in my ability to just kind of analyze what's going on and to find other avenues, find ways to resolving whatever, for lack of a better word, self-medicating I was doing. And, you know, not speaking for anyone else in the industry, but I can speak for the experience of living in New Orleans for several years and now knowing, and it's probably no secret to the rest of the country, that New Orleans celebrates indulgence. And that's okay. And it's part of the celebratory experience here. And I still enjoy that very much. But I think the most valuable tool for me has been finding a way to be content without that overindulgence, because for me personally, that overindulgence has in many ways made me miserable. And so I want to feel good. My goal is to feel good as often as possible. And I've gotten to a point where I know what makes me feel good and I know what I enjoy. And it's liberating in a sense to know that for yourself and to not have anyone else dictate that for you. So that's been a huge, huge learning experience for me particularly in the last few years. And I can't speak to the value of slowing down and coming from a place of connection with the sheer abundance that we have here in this city. That, for me, is what needs to be celebrated.
Sharon Floyd, founder of Bartanica.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Registered dietitian Molly Kimball has made a tremendous mark on the restaurant landscape through her collaboration with Ochsner Hospital. It's a free service called Eat Fit NOLA. So, Molly, fill us in on the latest news with Eat Fit NOLA.
Oh, gosh. Well, we're really excited about how well it's been received in the community, the excitement of the people in the community. They're asking for it at their favorite restaurants. And so it's really grown. So over the about year and a half that we've really been going strong with it, we're now up to about 50 local restaurants. We have some nationally with Copeland's and Cheesecake Bistro at all of their locations, but locally still about 50, ranging from your little neighborhood hole in the wall to just the high-end amazing gourmet restaurants that we have here, and they're really all embracing it. And we work back and forth with the chefs or the restaurant owners to identify either existing menu items that are nutritious or develop new ones. And so the criteria that we use is really pretty straightforward. No white carbs, less than a teaspoon of added sugar. We keep it centered mostly on lean proteins, healthy fats, and then we cap the sodium according to the American Heart Association's guidelines, and also animal-based saturated fat. We limit that as well. So we look at these recipes from the chefs, and we see what fits either as is or maybe with slight modifications. And if the chef is okay making those and it's something that we all agree on, then that goes on the menu. There's a little Eat Fit NOLA seal that's on the menu next to those items to identify it. So for us as registered dietitians, it's taking the guesswork out of it for you.
What are some of the results you're hearing? What are you, because I imagine you've got a pretty good dialogue going on with the community as well as the restaurant community. So what's the feedback you're getting?
The feedback from the consumers is, I'm so glad that I don't have to make all these special orders. So instead of saying, I'd like the fish, but instead of the white rice, can I get vegetables? And instead of the creamy sauce, can I get this? We're doing all that for them. So they can just point to that dish on there and they don't have to be that person making all these special requests. And so they like knowing that they can go into any of these restaurants that they love, make these healthy choices, and they're not having to second guess it, because a lot of times what might seem like it's okay or nutritionally on the menu, it really isn't. It's been eye-opening to us, even as dietitians, that some of these dishes that read healthfully aren't, you know. A lot of dishes that, you know, when someone goes into a restaurant and they're trying to make that healthy choice, they tend to gear towards more the fish or chicken dishes. And a lot of times, either the way they're prepared or the sauces with it or the side items with it, sometimes we might be looking at 1,500 or more calories, where something like the chicken dishes or, the beef dishes or pork dishes might be something they don't think is an option, but it's actually a fraction of the calories and saturated fat and sodium. So you don't have to guess anymore. It's just right there for you. So I think that's been a big thing of just giving people the peace of mind and that make them stand out from their friends.
You make the chef roll his eyes in the kitchen.
Exactly, exactly.
I recently heard a stat that fabulous white chocolate bread pudding at the Palace Cafe actually rings in at about 1,500 calories all in and of itself. So you better have like one for the table of 10. What about desserts?
Desserts are a little harder. And we actually, when we work with the restaurants, we'll just ask them for the things that we think have a good chance of fitting into Eat Fit NOLA. So we try not to give them too hard of a time about the things that don't fit. So we haven't done the analysis of their white chocolate bread pudding, but that would be interesting. Desserts can be a little tricky because we do limit added sugar to not more than about a teaspoon. But there are, Commander's Palace has some low sugar sorbets that mm-hmm. they've done, for example. The desserts have probably been the biggest challenge. And when we do work with companies that provide natural, plant-based, no-calorie sweeteners, and so we can supply the restaurants with those as samples to experiment with. We do have Eat Fit Nola cocktails, not more than 2 ounces of alcohol, again, not more than a teaspoon of added sugar, and we cap the calories at about 150 calories. It's about what you get in a normal glass of wine. And so that's been a lot of fun for the mixologists and bar chefs to play around with. Some do use those natural, no-calorie, plant-based sweeteners. Others are just using the different natural flavors of the different liquors that they're experimenting with. So that's been a blast, and it's been a hit with our restaurants.
What great fun. So tell me, I know you've always got so many things going on at one time. What's on the horizon?
Well, one of the things we're really excited about is we have an Eat Fit Nola app coming out, and that's going to be in conjunction with the City of New Orleans has an initiative called Fit Nola, and that's a citywide initiative to have New Orleans be in one of the top 10 healthiest cities by the city's anniversary in 2018. And they have a full blueprint of how to do this, more better access to walking paths, bike share programs, the full spectrum, very detailed plan of how to do this, and our restaurant program fills that little gap. So we're working very closely with the City of New Orleans, and so we're doing an app in conjunction with Fit Nola to where wherever you are in the city, you can click on the app and look to see what's the Eat Fit Nola restaurant near you.
Oh, I can't wait.
And you'll be able to see not only what restaurants it is, but you can see what the menu is, and we'll have images of the restaurant, of the dishes on there as well.
Well, move over, Yelp. Here comes Eat
Right.
Fit Nola.
Right.
Congratulations,
yeah,
Molly.
Thank you.
Keep us informed with all the big Eat Fit Nola news. Come back soon.
All right. Thank you very much.
Molly Kimball of Ochsner Hospital's Eat Fit Nola. For more than 50 years, Betty Fussell has been writing about Americans and their relationship with food. Her writings have appeared in scholarly journals, popular magazines, and national newspapers, collecting more distinguished awards along the way than any other food writer I can name. Betty wants us to talk about food, think about food, cook it, and most of all, eat it. One of Betty's favorite foods is steak. That's why she wrote Raising Steaks, The Life and Times of American Beef.
First of all, I love steak. Who doesn't? But more than that, it's really an icon of America because it's fast, it's mobile, it requires the least amount of cooking of any food. So it's as if it's a kind of slap in the face, none of that la-di-da, we're cowboys, we're on the range, we're eating steak. This is that, which makes it always special. It really is our kind of special, let's go out and have a really celebratory meal. But beyond that, I started from the base of corn because corn was iconic. And I didn't know it, but corn really built the civilizations of our hemisphere.
And you wrote a seminal book about corn. The Story of Corn, I believe, was the name of it.
Well, this was back in the days before there had been any single subject books. It was a book about food. And this was still, you know, we didn't do that in those days. They were mostly cookbooks. But I loved finding out and exploring how come corn was a staple. Well, I didn't even realize that it was born in Mexico and went north and went south. It's our grain, as wheat is European and rice is Asian. And it built the civilizations of this hemisphere. Olmec, Maya, Aztec, and eventually our entire agribusiness. I love that arc.
So once you made that whole corn connection, part of what you discovered about the prairies, as I understand it, had to do with the disappearance of the buffalo.
We had to get rid of the buffalo, said one of our generals, in order to get rid of the Indians. By the end of the 19th century, there was something like 200 buffalo left. Mm-hmm. We exterminated the buffalo so that the prairies were available. And after World War II, we had an excess of nitrogen from the explosives industry. And where's all that nitrogen going to have to go? Let's put it into fertilizer. The fertilizers go in the cornfield. We have a massive surplus of corn. Where's the corn going to go? Into livestock. Corn on the hoof. So suddenly, we have all of our livestock being fed in enormous feedlots on corn.
And that's just not the natural sort of thing to do, is it?
Well, maybe it's okay for pigs, and it's okay for chickens, but you do that with ruminants, you do that with cows and with sheep, particularly cows who have four stomachs, four chambers designed for one purpose only, turning cellulose, turning grass into a digestible thing for them. If you change that and make your primary feed corn, high protein, you wrecked their stomachs and you've created a great loss because the grass isn't being harvested that way. But it's been very ruinous, as we have increasingly come to know, both for the environment, for the animals, and for ourselves.
So in essence, what does the difference turn out on the plate between grass-fed and corn-fed beef?
I've done a beef tasting, and that's how to do it. Do it like a wine tasting. Take 12 kinds of beef and use corn-fed, use different breeds and different pastures. It's going to be like butter. They're going to taste differently wherever they fed. It depends what the pastures are like, the whole ecology. And very much it depends on the breed. Now, Angus became the commodity breed because it puts on weight fastest. And it means it puts on fat within the tissue. It also puts a thick layer of waste fat on the outside. So you have a huge waste in this method of intensive feeding. We're trying to get away from that. We're trying to get back to grass. And A, the flavor returns. I grew up on grass. Everybody did before World War II, essentially. And suddenly the meat got blander and blander and more like any kind of indistinguishable blah. Oh, and you lose texture as well. The commodity beef guys will say, but you've also lost fat and all the flavors in the fat. Not true. The flavors in the muscle, fat simply conveys flavor. And you can always use a little more olive oil or a little more beef fat in cooking your steak. But what you want is the flavor in the meat, just as you want the flavor in the wine.
There's also a huge difference with this whole system and what it's doing to our world, right?
Well, let's say it's an industrial chain that cannot sustain itself because there are so many things that are wrong with it. Common sense says this is not a good way to raise cattle. So we want to get back to some of the earlier forms of pasturages, back to some of the earlier breeds so that they're not all Angus. The major commodity beef is simply Angus, and not really full percentage Angus, but all it has to be is 51% Angus. Or as some guys say, you know, just as long as you have a black cow, we can call it Angus.
Well, Betty, thank you so much for joining us on Louisiana Eats.
Thank you for being here and staying just the way you are. May Louisiana always eat.
Scholar and author, Betty Fussell. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we'll get into the holiday spirit with jeweler and philanthropist Ninon Faget.
I thought, I'm going to make a necklace because they were little pearls called rice pearls. Don't tell me why I did red beans and rice, but I did it as a whimsical thing. I like whimsy. You know, life is too short not to have a little fun.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's.
Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakamin Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.